This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
By the authority vested in me as president, by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, writes George W. Bush in an executive order issued July 17th, just a couple of days ago. Welcome to our program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. By the authority vested in me as president, by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, including the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the National Emergencies Act, and Section 301 title of Title 3 of the U.S. Code, I, George W. Bush, President of the United States, find that due to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States posed by acts of violence threatening the peace and stability of Iraq. Now, isn't this weird? Here he is declaring a state of emergency based on Iraq and undermining efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq and to provide humanitarian assistance to the Iraqi people. It is in the interests of the United States to take additional steps with respect to the national emergency declared in Executive Order 13303 on May 22, 2003, and expanded in Executive Order 13315 of August 28, 2003, and relied upon for additional steps taken in Executive Order 13350 of July 29, 2004, and Executive Order 13364 of November 29, 2004. I hereby order, except to the extent provided in sections blah blah and regulations blah blah, all property and interests in property of the following persons who are in the United States or who hereinafter come within the United States or that are hereinafter come within the possession or control of United States persons are blocked and may not be transferred, paid, exported, withdrawn, or otherwise dealt in. And then there's a colon. So they're talking about the assets, the property and interests of any of the people who qualify under the rest of the sentence. And the rest of the sentence says, any person determined by the Secretary of State, any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to have committed or pose a risk, a significant risk of committing an act or acts of violence that have the purpose or effect of threatening the peace or stability of Iraq, undermining efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq, to have material assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, logistical, or technical support for, blah, 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 to be owned, controlled by, blah, blah. The prohibitions in the subsection shall include but not limited to the making of any contribution or provision of funds, goods, or services by, to, or for the benefit of persons whose property, et cetera, et cetera. And even adds, any conspiracy formed to violate any of the prohibitions set forth in this order is prohibited. In other words, if you and I have a conversation about opposing Bush's policies in Iraq, George W. Bush can now claim that we are conspirators, and under this executive order issued on the 17th of July, 2007, just several days ago, George W. Bush can have you and I have all of our assets frozen, our credit cards frozen, our bank accounts taken, our homes seized, our cars seized, and we are immediately rendered non-persons in the United States, homeless persons in the United States, and what? Well, there's a lot of people pushing back on this, not just this particular executive order, but just this whole idea that the President of the United States has powers that even King George III didn't claim. One of them is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts is an economist, nationally syndicated columnist. He served as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, earning fame as the father of Reaganomics. We've got to have a conversation about that sometime. He's the former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and Scripps Howard News Service, and was a former contributing editor to William F. Buckley's publication, The National Review. Writing over at counterpunch.org, he has a new piece out that I wanted to talk with him about. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Or I should say, welcome back. It seems we talk about once a year and have for the last 3 or 4 years. Good to have you with us. You are, as a conservative. Last time we talked, you were a Republican. First of all, do you still both wear those labels?
I don't think I'll ever vote for another Republican, no.
Okay. You are in your column a couple of days ago, you said, and I quote from the first sentence, and I'd like to use this just as the stepping off point to find out your thoughts on all this stuff. You say, unless Congress immediately impeaches Bush and Cheney, a year from now, the U.S. could be a dictatorial police state at war with Iran. Those are very, very strong words, sir, coming from a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration.
Well, I don't actually think they're very strong. I get a lot of flack that they're understated and the situation is worse than I say. Consider, for example, the executive order you were reading from before we started talking. You realize, of course, that when Bush exercises this authority, which I don't believe he has, there's no check to it. It doesn't have to be ratified by Congress. The people who bear the brunt of these dictatorial police state actions have no recourse to the judiciary. So it really is a form of just total one-man absolute rule. Now, most Americans will say, well, I don't have anything to fear. I'm not doing anything wrong. If that's the case, Tom, why did the founders write the Constitution of the United States? Did they write it only for people who were doing things wrong and had things to fear? So the American people don't really understand the danger that they face. And they also don't understand, Tom, that by any normal political calculation, as the Los Angeles Times pointed out yesterday in the article, Bush the Albatross, where Ronald Brownstein just reminded everyone of conventional political information, which is that, to quote him, unpopular presidents have consistently undercut their party in the next election. 88% of voters who disapproved of the retiring president's job performance voted against his party's nominee in past elections, on average 80%. Of voters who disapproved of a president's performance, they voted against his party's candidates, even in House races. Now, the article goes on to point out that given Bush's dismal approval record, rating, where he stands, it's a total wipeout for Republicans in 2008. And numerous pundits have used these well-known political facts in support of the conclusion that this is the reason the Democrats have not brought a halt to Bush's follies or the war, because they expect his unpopular policies to provide them with a landslide victory in next year's election. So everyone, if you look at conventional wisdom, Bush makes no sense. Cheney makes no sense. Now, the problem's reasoning is it assumes that Cheney and Rove and the Republicans are ignorant of these facts, or it assumes that they are content for the Republican Party to be destroyed after Bush has his fling.
And you consider neither of those to be, you know, reality.
Those are not reality. So what this tells anybody who's paying attention, that it's much more likely that Cheney and Roe have in mind events that will once again rally the people behind President Bush and behind the Republican Party that is fighting the war on terror that the Democrats want to lose. So that's what we're headed for. I mean, you and your listeners don't believe that the Republican Party has decided just to self-destruct so Bush could have his ego fling. I mean, or that Cheney could act like a fool for 8 years. Is something's in the works. And when it happens, whether it's authentic or whether it's orchestrated and staged, all of those executive orders are implemented. They're implemented just like that. And they go far beyond the ones that you quoted. They essentially create a dictatorial police state in which Congress and the judiciary have no roles.
And these executive, I'd like to talk with you about these executive orders and how they come about and what kind of power they have and what can be done about them. Can you stick around right after the break and we'll continue this conversation? Because we do have to take a break
here.
Great. Thank you. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts. His newest piece over at counterpunch.org, an economist, nationally syndicated columnist, former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, known as the father of Reaganomics, former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's time for all of us to stand up. By the way, congratulations to Individual Primeval, the screen name of the blogger who posted over at the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog and the Tom Hartman Show's blog about healthcare. Thanks, as always, for a great show, etc. Regarding the healthcare thing, we are, that as we do every day, our favorite blog posting of the day. We're going to send you a copy of my book, which is out now, new in paperback, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we can do about it. Also, a call-out to our folks, our friends in Grand Rapids and in Western Michigan. I'll be in Grand Rapids tomorrow for a special live broadcast and book signing at the Celebration Cinema North. We'll be doing the show there, and I'll be signing books there. And then also at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, I'll be at Schuller's Bookstore in Grand Rapids. WTKG is our affiliate, and WTKG.com is the website for more information. If you're in Western Michigan, you'd like to drop by and say hi and see us tomorrow. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts, an economist, nationally syndicated columnist, former assistant secretary of Treasury in the Reagan administration, former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and the National Review. Paul Craig Roberts, yesterday we talked with Bruce Fein, and he was arguing that impeachment against Bush and Cheney must proceed immediately in order to rescue the Constitution, in as much as the executive branch has taken on powers to itself that were never envisioned by the founders, and in fact even exceed the powers that Julius Caesar and King George III took to themselves. That is, the power to reach into any nation in the world and seize people and torture them, imprison them, whatever, without habeas corpus. You're making a slightly different argument. You're suggesting that the Republicans, and this is a little bit more of a political calculation, that the Republicans are not stupid, that they realize that they're going to go down in flames in 2008, and so something terrible is going to happen between now and then to stop that from happening. Do I have that right?
That's what they keep telling us. Michael Chertoff, the so-called Homeland Security Director. Now, notice, too, Tom, Homeland, that's a Nazi term. When have Americans ever call this the Homeland? I mean, this is a brand-new thing they've created, you see.
Well, in fact, apropos of that, if I may, this is just a 20-second clip. Hitler and Hess studied the Zionist movement when they were writing Mein Kampf, when Hitler was in jail, when he was in prison. And the Zionist movement at the time, you know, was arguing for a homeland for the Jews. And they thought, we need to capture that word and create this notion of blood and soil for the German people. And so Rudolf Hess, in 1934, at the Nuremberg rallies, first introduced the word homeland, Heimat is the word, into the German vocabulary. Prior to that, it had always been Vaterland, you know, fatherland.
Right.
And here is Rudolf Hess introducing Adolf Hitler in 1934 at the Nuremberg rallies. This is from Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will movie. It's just a very short clip. Notice the word Heimat, and then he says, for all of the Deutsche, alles der Deutsche in der ganze Welt, all of the Germans in the entire world.
Dank ihrer Führung.
Thanks to our Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen. Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein. A homeland. Here we have.
Heimat zu sein. Für alle Deutschen der Welt.
And then he introduces Hitler, and Hitler gets up and speaks and starts using the word homeland for the very first time. And I don't remember the word homeland ever being used in the context of the United States before now.
No, it's a brand new Bush regime invention, and all that cheering that we were hearing from the Hitler rally. If you've ever attended one of the Bush speeches where the crowd is programmed and they start screaming USA, 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 it's sort of eerie. It's sort of eerily similar. Now, to get back to your question, first of all, Bruce Fein is completely correct. I totally agree with him. Second, yes, I take one more step. I point out that administration figures themselves and prominent Republican propagandists, including and also the recent intelligence report, National Intelligence Estimate, are preparing us for another 9/11 event or series of events. Chertoff has predicted them. Rick Santorum, the former Republican senator, said recently that that all this anti-war attitude of the American public would soon disappear after the next series of attacks that we were going to experience. And, of course, the National Intelligence Estimate is saying that Al-Qaeda has regrouped, is strong again, and is sending operatives here to the U.S. to blow us up again. So you have to count on the fact that if Al-Qaeda is not going to do it, it's going to be orchestrated, because there's no other way to pull the Republican Party's bacon out of the fire. Just the other day, one of the libertarian sites, Lou Rockwell, had this fellow, Grieg, pointing out that the Republicans are praying for another 9/11. It's the only way they can be saved from total wipeout. So,
Paul Craig Roberts, we have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. Can you stick around with us for another 10 minutes or so?
Okay, Tom, I'll give you another 10 minutes. Be glad.
If you can, I would very much appreciate it, because I'd like to ask, you know, what you think are the specific remedies. What can we do about this? What should we do about this? And not just impeachment, but you know, what else can American citizens do? We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, and that's what we're concerned about, is the world changing in the wink of an eye. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts. He's an economist, nationally syndicated columnist. His columns appear these days at VDare.com, Counterpunch.com, Antiwar.com. The former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, earning fame as the father of Reaganomics, former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, for Business Week, Scripps Howard News Service, and former contributing editor to the National Review. And Paul Craig Roberts, you were talking about concern that something would happen, another Reichstag fire, another 9/11, that would allow the Republicans in general and the Bush administration in particular to reconsolidate their power and the national consensus around them. And I'm sorry, we commercial breaks. Continue that train of thought, and what we can do about it. Impeachment doesn't seem to be something that's going to happen immediately. What other options do we have, or how should we pursue that?
Well, Tom, short of impeachment, the only thing that could be done is for a majority of the American people to be more aware of what's really going on and how these attacks will be orchestrated, if necessary, in order to save the Republican Party. If enough people were suspicious and alert, it would be harder for the administration to get away with it. I don't think these wake-up calls are likely to be effective. One reason is what is known as the mainstream media is highly concentrated and controlled by about five huge mega corporations that will not cross the government. And So you're not going to get any news out that way other than what the government wants out. So I don't know that we can do anything. I write and try to make people aware that how the world really works. Let me read you. In the break, I quickly penned a speech that we'll likely hear from Bush before the next election and after the next attack. And as I say, it's the administration predicting these attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Here's his speech. My administration knew that there would be more attacks from these terrorists who hate us and our way of life and are determined to destroy every one of us. If only more of you had believed me and supported my war on terror, these new attacks would not have happened. Our security efforts were impaired by the Democrats' determined attempts to surrender to the terrorists by forcing our withdrawal from Iraq and by civil libertarian assaults on our necessary security measures. If only more Americans had trusted their government, this would not have happened. Now, that's what we're headed for.
Yeah.
We're either headed for that or the total wipeout of the Republican Party, unless all political wisdom, all past behavior of the electorate toward unpopular administrations and elections somehow evaporates.
Yeah, that kind of language is eerily reminiscent of Mein Kampf.
It always works.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's extraordinary. So,
Americans think their danger is terrorists. They don't understand that terrorists cannot take away habeas corpus, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. It cannot suspend the constitutional government, abolish the separation of powers. It can't pick them up or shut them up or pick them up and arrest them. The terrorists are not anything like the threat that we face to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution from our own government in the name of fighting terrorism. Americans just aren't able to perceive that, or at least not enough of them are.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting that given that the mainstream media isn't going to get behind this thing, and given that the majority of Americans are not going to be awake to it, and the old trick which has been used so many times going all the way back to Julius Caesar is going to work, that what we have to do is get these guys out of office before they have an opportunity to pull the trigger on this gun that they've already loaded with all these executive orders. In other words, impeach
exactly,
Bush and Cheney.
Exactly. Bruce Fein, who was an assistant attorney general, I think, in the Reagan administration. He's absolutely correct. If you notice, it's the Republicans like Bruce Fein, myself. Pat Buchanan is a diehard Republican. Just the other day, he published a piece saying that we are due for a new Gulf of Tonkin event. That's why we've got three carrier strike forces in the congested waters off Iran.
Yeah,
it's so obvious to people like us who have long been associated in the government, in the corridors of power, watching how it behaves, seeing everybody in the government chafe under every constraint that's imposed on them, and they always want to get rid of these constraints. And there's no belief in the people or anything like that. They have agendas. The people are in the way. The Constitution's in the way. They're all willing to cut it down, to go chase after whatever agenda that they think is important.
When you were in the Reagan administration, you know, they had their difficult time, Iran-Contra in particular, and the allegations that maybe they had cut a deal, that Bush had cut a deal, William Casey had cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages prior to the 1980 election. I mean, there were some pretty nasty rumors flying around, and there were some serious investigations by Congress. Do you think that the Reagan administration or the Republican Party at that time, in the 1980s, would have ever contemplated the kinds of things that, frankly, have already been done by this administration,
or the kinds
of things that you're anticipating?
No, it's impossible. They never would have done it. It took 9/11 to make these types of things possible. And also, you know, Reagan had a problem with neoconservatives, but it was not a neoconservative administration, and he fired their ass.
Yeah.
And some of them were prosecuted. though they were later pardoned because he was under great pressure. How can you let these anti-communists be punished? Because
you mean like Cap Weinberger?
Well, like the current guy on the National Security Council. And you see, we at the time, though, there was still the Soviet threat. I mean, it was, in some sense, certainly a potential threat. But Iraq and terrorism, they're nothing like the Soviet Union with massive array of intercontinental ballistic missiles and, you know, enormous political power. And so, no, Reagan, the Reagan administration was not neoconservative. He got pushed into things by them because they had infiltrated the government, Richard Pearl, people like that. But they never succeeded in taking it over and running it and hitching it to their agendas. They had some agendas, and they blew up on them. And like I said, Reagan fired them, and they were a problem. But they themselves concluded from that they had to have a new Pearl Harbor in order to succeed, and they got one with 9/11.
Yeah, that was the language from the Project for New American Century's 1998 document that was signed by Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense.
It would take massive awareness of the population, demonstrations, protests, demands, strikes. I mean, it would take an enormous outpouring that the American people simply aren't able to produce. So I don't think the only constraints on what's going to happen will come from the federal bureaucracy and perhaps the military. They may have had enough.
The military may push back.
Not go along with it.
And maybe you and I can help stimulate some of that massive public outcry that you were just talking about. Paul Craig Roberts, you're a patriot, sir, and I appreciate your being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Tom, for sharing your audience.
Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
Lord help me, Jesus, we didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here.
Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. It gets really spooky when Republicans are serious. Yesterday and today, you've heard from two senior officials from the Reagan administration calling out the Bush administration. I take this very seriously. Michelle in Central Valley, California. Hey, Michelle.
Hello.
What's up?
Tom? Oh, good morning.
Yeah.
I think it's probably not so crazy for those of us who think that or know that 9/11 was done from the inside. Doesn't seem so nuts anymore, does it?
Yeah.
I was calling because I heard a theory last night, and I hadn't even considered it before, but, Cheney obviously is behind everything. He's controlled everything from the beginning, and they don't need Bush anymore. So, maybe this catastrophic event during the summer is something that takes Bush away.
And, oh, no.
You know
God,
what I'm
God
saying?
God forbid. I mean, that kind of, God forbid. I mean, it just
I
any
hate
kind
to,
of...
I hate to even consider it, but... there's nothing that's impossible with these madmen.
I think Bush is still a useful idiot for Cheney, and he's not going to find a better one, frankly, I don't think.
Well, he's got everything in place. All these executive orders are set up to start a whole new time for us.
Yeah,
what does he need Bush for?
Right. Yeah. No. These executive orders and well, not only that. I mean, Congress has some complicity in this as well. The
Absolutely.
Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act. They've done away with habeas corpus. They've done away with the posse comitatus. The U.S. military can now attack us. They allow private corporations to sell their services as hired guns in the cities of New Orleans and other cities in the United States. I mean, this is truly bizarre. Michelle, thank you for your call. Jeff in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, remember how Al Gore recently said that he didn't fight the 2000 election issue because the next step would be a violent overthrow, and we're not ready for that?
Yes.
Well, you would think after what Mr. Roberts just said, if not now, when? But I'm not saying I agree with that point. It just seems like then we need to find some other alternative, otherwise our goose is cooked. And he also mentioned how creating awareness is, you know, among those 28% that still support Bush, that would be the alternative to how we get out of this, right?
Well, and the other thing that Paul Craig Roberts said that I thought, you know, that was the real, yeah, I really agree with that, is the military. I have a strong sense that the military increasingly is unwilling to go along with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and that if these guys were to order the military to come after the American people and create martial law, that the revolt, and it wouldn't be I don't think it would be a violent revolt. I think that it would be a passive revolt. I think that the revolt would come from within. The military would simply say, sorry, we're not going to go there. And at that point, he would have the choice of pulling out one of the many private armies that have been created now in the United States, who may or may not go along with it. I don't know. It depends on whether these guys salute the Constitution, or whether they salute the dollar, you know, where their ultimate loyalties lie, and whether or not, frankly, the military would even allow that, or the police departments of the United States. But we've seen such a militarization of our police departments. We see, you know, the SWAT teams on average in the United States twice a day. The wrong house has its door kicked in, and people are attacked by SWAT teams in the United States. That's the and in the 50s and 60s it was zero. In the 70s, it was zero. This is a new phenomena, the militarization of police in the United States. And so, you know, a lot of stuff is in place right now, just as a lot of stuff got put into place in 1933, 1934, 1935 in Germany. And it concerns me. Jim in San Mateo. Hey, Jim.
Yes, thanks, Tom. You know, I get pretty tired of the Bush and Cheney making us a nation of cowards. And with this, let's fight them over there before we fight them over here. We're 300 million people, and like you were saying, I know they sound like they're militarized, but we have police and sheriff and fire. We have
yeah. If they want to fight us here, bring them on.
We can fight them here. We can keep it up. Now we're going to get bloodied. You know, maybe so, but. You know, London didn't move out of London. The Israelis
exactly. No, we have been through this before. These guys are spitting on the grave of James Madison, who was the president when in 1812 the British and the Canadians invaded the United States and burned down the White House. And Bush is running around like, oh, the United States has never been attacked before. Come on, read some history. This is from a guy who supposedly has a degree in history, although he did not study the law, tragically. Lonnie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Lonnie.
How are you? I was told that this might happen years ago from a friend who had also been reading some of the neoconservative, you know.
Well, the first executive order that allowed the suspension of elections was during the Nixon administration during Vietnam.
Right. But wouldn't the people rise up against a situation like this? I know I'm a former West Pointer, and I know the guys that were in my units and whatnot. We would definitely not be willing to go along with someone sweeping our Constitution into the fire.
They've already done it.
Well, I mean, yes. I agree with
that. I mean,
that.
They've already done it. Where are the people out there protesting the loss of habeas corpus? Where are the people out there protesting the fact that the Bush administration now claims they can sneak into your house and go through your stuff without a court order, without a warrant? Where are the people protesting the fact that the Bush administration can snatch you off the streets? And they have done it. And they have done it. And put you in prison for the rest of your life without any opportunity to challenge it in the courts.
I'm with you exactly on this, Tom. It's crazy.
It is, Lonnie. Lonnie, I'm sorry, I've got to wrap this hour up, but, and I want to kind of break this state. Let's talk about higher education for a minute and some of the highest goals for America rather than the darkest fears. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. As we, you know, in the midst of our concerns about the future direction of our country, or the ongoing future survival of our Constitution, I think it's important that we also focus on what we could do right, the positive directions that we could go, the kinds of things that could restore to America the, you know, I know it almost sounds hokey to say the greatness we once had, but it's true. I mean, America, the United States of America, for many years, for the better part of two centuries, on and off, anyway, but I'd say for the better part of two centuries, was viewed as that city on the hill, to quote George Winthrop, the Puritan, you know, that John Kennedy quoted in his inaugural address, and then Ronald Reagan requoted, although he tossed the word shining in there. America was that city on the hill. We were the country everyone else wanted to be like. And after World War II, most of the countries of Western Europe imitated us and took it a step further, with things like national health care, which Harry Truman introduced in 1947, and the Republicans shot down. They controlled the House and Senate at that time. And widespread public higher education, the availability of it, which in the United States took by and large the form of the GI Bill after World War II. But it educated a generation of people like my dad, you know, the first person in his family to go to college. My mother, actually she wasn't the first, but nonetheless, the point made that higher education is one of the keys to rebuilding this country. And we have an ongoing train wreck with higher education right now. One of the people trying to do something about this is Congressman George Miller, the Democrat from California. He represents the 7th District of California. His website, house.gov/George Miller. And Congressman Miller, welcome to the program. Oh.
Hello?
What happened? Yeah. Hey, Congressman Miller.
Tom, thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. Tell us about what you're doing to try to bring back something that in some ways I would say kind of resembles the GI Bill.
Well, it's very similar to the GI Bill. In fact, it's the largest commitment by the federal government to help students and families pay for education since the GI Bill, which is kind of an indictment of the government, but here we are. In any case, we're taking $18 billion in fees that were paid to the banks and the lenders and the student loan program that have turned out to be very excessive. We're going to take those away from the banks and the lenders, and we're recycling it to the benefit of students and their families. We're doing that by increasing the Pell Grant for low-income students by $500 over the next 5 years. And we're doing it by cutting interest rates on the subsidized student loans for middle-income families and low-income families that borrow money to go to college, to take that rate from 6.8% to 3.5%. And that has a big impact on the cost of college for those students. And then we also have provisions in here to provide tuition forgiveness for people, high-performing students that want to become teachers. We have loan forgiveness. $5,000 if you go into teaching or to social work or to a prosecutor, public defender, fireman, police officer, the public service employments where the wages aren't the highest and the beginning salaries aren't the greatest, but they're careers and many people want to go into them, but they're reluctant to do that because they carry around so much debt from college. So we want to provide some forgiveness for those students so they can pursue those careers.
It's a great step. It raises two kind of directions that we could go in this conversation, Congressman Miller. The first is most of the countries of Western Europe offer free college education all the way to the level of PhD. They may not pay for Oxford, you know, for the colleges in Oxford, but they will pay for the state colleges and, you know, the equivalent of Michigan State University or the University of California. And in fact, the University of California did that. Reagan ended that.
That's how we built our state. That's how we built our state. I was the beginning when they first were changing over from free to tuition. And but the fact is that state built its economic future on the investment in those colleges, in those universities, and in the students and families that resided there. You know, when Ireland was in the doldrums 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they made a decision that the only way that they were going to get out of the doldrums, the only way that people were going to stop leaving Ireland and going to other parts of the world for jobs, was to give a free college education. And of course, Ireland now is one of the economic, you know, hot items in all of Europe. They have more economic activity, more jobs. People are now coming back to Ireland to go to work and to pursue careers, and investments being made by companies from all over the world in Ireland. You know, economists tell us all the time, this is the best investment you can make with taxpayer dollars is in education. It comes back to you many, many, many times.
Yeah, well, that said then, why don't we take the position in the United States, as they have in so many of these European countries, and frankly in some other countries around the world as well, Japan, for example, why don't we take the position that education is a right and not a privilege? I mean, we've already taken that position with regard to K through 12, and simply say, you know, we're going to figure out a way, if it can't be done at the state level, and obviously the states have failed at this, we're going to figure out a way at the national level that anybody in the United States who can qualify to go to college, intellectually qualify, you know, who has the capacity to function in college, can go to college. I mean, that was what Thomas Jefferson said when he created the University of Virginia as the first taxpayer-funded free institution of higher learning. And he said, you know, the family into which you are born should not be an impediment to your being able to become anything you want in this world. I'm paraphrasing here. He was much more eloquent than I. But I know you're moving in that direction, but why not just go for the whole thing?
Well, we're not going for the whole thing because certainly in our particular case, when we took over the Congress, when the Democrats took over the Congress this last election, you know, we're swimming in a sea of red ink that was left to us because of the tax cuts for the very wealthy, because of the fact that they're running a war on the credit card. But we at a minimum, what we wanted to do was make this effort. Speaker Pelosi made it very clear that we were going to deal with the cost of college. We did it in the first 100 hours with our 6406. This is the follow-on legislation. As I said, this is the biggest investment we've made in helping people pay for college.
And it's a great step, and I didn't mean to minimize it.
No, I understand, but tragically, we've been living now, you know, since the Reagan years, where everybody's been privatizing education, making it more expensive. People have to spend much more dollars to do that. We now have a case where we now can document. We have several hundred thousand students who are fully qualified to go to college. Don't go because they do not believe they will be able to afford it, or they don't want to carry around that kind of debt. And that's a bad omen for America if we're turning away fully qualified individuals because of the cost of college. It's one thing to say you're not qualified because you didn't do your schoolwork and you didn't do what was necessary to prepare for college. But to say you can't go because you can't afford it?
Right. And which raises the second issue. We're talking with Congressman George Miller of the 7th District of California. His website, house.gov/George Miller. And that is that this is probably one of the clearest, brightest, unassailable examples of the utter failure of the idea that privatizing the commons, corporatizing the commons, taking that stuff that we collectively have taken under our wing, our fire departments, our police departments, our education system, et cetera, that privatizing the commons, the mantra of the conservatives, has been a failure. Privatizing the loan program for higher education has been an absolute disaster.
It's a failure in healthcare. It's a failure in education. I mean, the fact of the matter is these are the commons. These are the things that make a society sustainable. These are the things that make the next generation available to be the discoverers, the innovators, the economic growers. It's that investment in education that allows all that to happen. When John Kennedy called for the landing on the moon, it was more than a moonshot. It was building this incredible intellectual capacity with free graduate fellowships, 28,000 of them. And those people ended up founding Hewlett-Packard, you know, founding the whole next technological revolution. So many of those people who graduated in those science fellowships, those engineering fellowships, those mathematic fellowships that went on after the moonshot, after their career, that part of their career, went into the private sector. And if you look at California, we were the inheritors of that. The next generation is Silicon Valley. And this is a question of whether this generation will make the same kind of investment that my grandparents made before they ever met me and my parents made after they met me. And we've been living off of that. And the question is now, are we going to make this next round of investment so that America can continue economic leadership and maintain a democratic society through education? Yep.
So hopefully our listeners will contact their members of Congress and the Senate and say, you know, we think that George Miller's bill, his legislation to reduce student, this is still moving toward the Senate, right?
Yes, the Senate's debating it as we're discussing it, Tom.
Great. Okay, so call your senators. 16 minutes past the hour. George Miller, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
It's the American dream, and yes, we are going to reclaim it. We're not going to let these guys take it. We are waking up. America, right across the board, all across the United States, is waking up, and we're saying enough already. Enough. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 550 days, 11 hours, 33 minutes, 5 seconds left before George W. Bush and Dick Cheney leave office voluntarily, barring impeachment. Talking with George Miller, Congressman George Miller, really ultimately what we were talking about was the commons, which leads us to our voting alert for the day.
Just a push of a button, just a touch of a screen. Welcome to the future, come try our voting machine.
Electronic voting machine.
This is from Steve, writing Stephen Rosenfeld over on alternate.org. The headline, Bush government to poor voters, we don't want you to vote. State welfare offices across the country are not offering millions of low-income Americans the opportunity to register to vote for when applying for public assistance, despite a federal law requiring them to do so. Gee, what a surprise the administration and its Republican one-party state machine ignoring the law. At the same time, the Justice Department's voting section, which is supposed to enforce voting rights and supervises elections in some states, is pressuring 10 states to do more to purge voter rolls before the 2008 presidential election, according to letters sent to state officials, state election officials this spring. Can you spell Florida or Ohio? As Steve Rosenfeld notes, the contrast of a Justice Department that apparently has not enforced voter registration opportunities for poor people who tend to vote Democratic and a department that is pressuring states to more thoroughly trim voter rolls has prompted some voting rights advocates to accuse the agency of selective enforcement and partisan bias. Gee, where would they get an idea like that? On Monday, July 16th, the House Judiciary Committee announced it was postponing a hearing scheduled for Tuesday, July 17th, quote, because the department refused to make voting section chief John Tanner available to testify. While the national media has followed the department's firing of U.S. attorneys, the department's oversight of the nation's voter rolls has gone mostly unnoticed. The potential impact on the 2008 election could be enormous. At the presidential level, at the congressional level, at the senatorial level, these guys are playing for keeps. And this is our commons, too. Our vote is our commons. Where did the crazy idea come that we should privatize the vote commons? You're talking with George Mitchell about the education commons. And then on top of that, we see, I mean, this is, I've talked about the cancer stage of capitalism. This is also the cancer stage of conservative ideology in government. Look at what happened in New York yesterday. Here we had a steam pipe blow up. It freaked everybody out. The point, though, is that it was a steam pipe that was built in 1924. And you have a mayor who is out there bragging about the fact, that he has cut taxes 23 times. A Republican mayor in New York. That, I'm speaking of Giuliani. Giuliani running around going, I was mayor of New York, and we cut taxes 23 times. We cut spending, too, I'm proud to say. Yes, Mr. Giuliani, you did. And the results of your Republican disinvestment in the commons? Not to mention the increase in poverty, not to mention the number of people who would like to go to not just college, but a decent high school or primary school, grade school, who can't. That legacy is all too visible now. What we are seeing is the consequences of the conservative belief, this bizarre conservative ideology that has ruled this country since the election of Ronald Reagan, since the Reagan Revolution. And it was very much not the case during the administrations of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Jerry Ford, Jimmy Carter. But all that was the FDR era. That was the era when we actually taxed people at a top rate of 70% to 90%, and we used that money to build the infrastructure and the commons of the United States. And we built fire departments and stations, and we built police departments and stations, and we built public education, and we built public universities, and we created and we built highways, and we built the steam tunnels, and we built infrastructure all across this nation that allowed for commerce to happen and allowed for people to have a decent life. And the cons came along and said, oh, we can't do that. Because to do that, you have to tax millionaires and billionaires, and that's a sin. And Reaganomics, you want to know who blew up the steam tunnel yesterday in New York City? I mean, there's all this, oh my God, was it the terrorists? No, it was the conservatives. They blew up the steam tunnel in New York City. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's all good. It's all right.
Hey, check out our blog over at airamerica.com. Click on the Tom Hartman page. It'll get you there. There's also links from there to tomhartman.com, where we have our message board area. Absolutely and totally free. You can participate in our message boards over at tomhartman.com, as well as on our blog at airamerica.com. Plus our free live chat room if you want to actually interact with live human beings while we're on the air, and me as well. I drop in during the breaks. That's also over at tomhartman.com, and there's a link to it from airamerica.com. And of course, at the end of the day, David's going to be picking out his favorite blog posting at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. It's actually called Louise Hartman's Blog. And just click on the number of comments little line there, and it'll pop it open for you. You can read the comments, and you can participate. So anyhow, here's the bottom line. If this were the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1940s for that matter, the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or even the early 1980s, and a steam pipe were to blow up in New York City. Back in the days when we actually had reporters who actually did investigative journalism, and there was a broad consensus in the United States that taxes are the price you pay for admission to a civil society, and that one of the jobs of government is to help build the infrastructure that allows business to flourish, that allows people to have a decent standard of living, that allows people to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. the question that would be being asked in the media and would have been asked from day one, you know, starting yesterday afternoon, minutes after the explosion, the question would be, how has the administration of New York City, how have two successive Republican administrations failed to maintain the critical infrastructure of the city while giving tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires? Or perhaps, how has conservative ideology failed? I mean, it's really time to put that meme out there again. Let's get back to the idea that there actually is a, this was Dwight Eisenhower's meme. I mean, you know, he was so clear about that anybody who thinks that they should, you know, privatize Social Security, do away with it, they're crazy. Anybody who does that, they're crazy. I mean, even Eisenhower was identifying these guys as crazy. Jim in Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
I'm on the air. Yes, sir. I'm a little nervous. But what I'm talking about is basically, my theme is just simply this. I'd like to have your comment about what I'm talking about. Democracy needs to be regulated, just like Vioxx. It was not regulated by the many. It was regulated by the few. It caused mirror corporations to hurt themselves, shoot themselves in the foot, and so on. When aspirin, on the other hand, was regulated by the people over a great period of time, and it doesn't hurt people. And this is the thing about democracy. The founding fathers of our country intended, yes, to slow growth a little bit, but yet it protected not only Vioxx, but it protected the people of this country. And that's what it's
all about. Well, it's not.
Hello?
Yeah, I get your point, Jim. I would slightly recalibrate that and say it's not democracy that needs to be regulated, although we do that with the Constitution. It is laissez-faire economics. It is capitalism that needs to be regulated, and it needs to be regulated, frankly, so that it will survive. Because if you look at the history of capitalism, the times that it has been most at risk are the times that it has been least regulated, and that's when you get things like the Republican Great Depression, when it falls over as a consequence of that.
Well, yes, but anything could be unregulated if you have people in dark doing things that are evil and corrupt, just like you mentioned about the steam thing that blew up in New York City the other day. You need to put things in the open. You need to have people with a forum to find out what is going on in this country. For instance, President Bush has got a conflict of interest with the oil companies. Obviously, the oil's not going to go down when he's president of the United States.
Yeah. And not just Bush, but Cheney as well. No, absolutely, Jim. Good point. And in fact, here, this is what Dwight Eisenhower wrote to his brother 3 years after he was elected president of the United States. Here's a sitting president of the United States writing a letter to his brother on November 8, 1954. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. The conservatives have no ideas whatsoever. The conservative notion, and by and large, I would say the Republican notion based on this, is destroy government. And what steps in to fill that vacuum? Corporations. And what do those corporations have as their first goal? Making money. Well, I'm all in favor of making money. I make money myself. In fact, I own a corporation myself that's making money. And that corporation must operate, in my opinion, or certainly should operate, within the context of what's best for the United States of America. Corporations that are engaged in toxic activity, whether it's dumping toxic waste on people or whether it's spreading toxic information, whatever they may be, they should be subject to the will of we the people. Corporations that are exploiting our system, corporations that are destroying our system, corporations that are creating harm for us, and government is we the people collectively. This is the thing people have forgotten. I mean, Reagan caused this bizarre amnesia. Where, you know, what he was representing as new ideas were actually a return to the Gilded Age, a return to the 1880s and to the 1920s, where the robber barons emerged, where the middle class vanished, where poverty exploded. The whole idea of trickle-down economics, this was sold to us as some kind of brilliant new idea. We know how to make government work. We've done it in the United States. We've done it very well. This country grew to be one of the greatest industrial democracies that have ever been seen in the world. In the 1950s and 60s and 70s, with the greatest level of social mobility, you had the greatest possibility of going from poverty to wealth in the United States in the 1970s that we have ever seen in the history of the United States. And now we are below all of the industrialized countries in the world in terms of social mobility. Your probability of becoming a millionaire right now if you are born poor or middle class is lower than in any other country in the world, any other developed country in the world, probably any other country in the world, period. Well, no, it's not lower than if you're in Zimbabwe. I'm sorry. It's lower than any other industrialized country in the world. It's time to return to the ideals on which this country was founded. Karen in Florida, you want to disagree with me? Karen?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Sir, I do disagree with you. I don't want to be disrespectful, but you spew out a lot of negativity and generalities, and I have never seen, and I'm not pro-democratic or Republican, I have not seen any strategies or constructive, intellectual or otherwise plans to handle Iraq or our social problems from the Democrats. What they do is...
Well, respectfully, then, you haven't been paying attention, Karen.
No, you are very...
The Democratic Party has offered a series of very specific proposals on how to deal with Iraq, number one. And number two, with regard to our social programs, with regard to our social programs, Karen, there have been a whole series of programs. You just heard George Mitchell. Let's go back to the GI Bill. Let's send people to college. I'm sorry, I had to put you on hold there. This isn't Fox News. We don't shout over each other. I'll let you talk. You're going to let me talk. Actually, I'll bring you back on here. Let's go back to educating people. The University of California, for example, the system used to be free. Thomas Jefferson had this idea of free college education for everybody. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with the government paying our health care bills and being the insurer of last resort or even the insurer of first resort rather than a system where William McGuire makes a $1.7 billion paycheck with your and my insurance premiums? I mean, we have a broken and dysfunctional system, Karen. I have heard nothing from the Republican Party to fix this other than tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
Yeah, okay, I understand. Now, am I allowed to speak?
Please.
We have 100 million people on psychiatric drugs in this country. We have the psychiatrists and pharmaceuticals that the Republicans and the Democrats, and mainly the Democrats, do push welfare programs that lead to more Prozac and Ritalin in the schools because the schools and the welfare programs fund these Ritalin programs. We have a future of drugs. Children, especially males, and we are complaining about 4,000 people being killed in Iraq, which is horrible. And we do need to do something about this. This is the real problem, is that...
Karen, if I may.
Psychiatric invasion of our thinking, our moral codes have been eroded, and our children are on Prozac and Ritalin. And
Karen, I'm very familiar with that. I've written 7 books about attention deficit disorder.
What?
The drugging of our children. And let me tell you, the communities in the United States, and these statistics are very easy to find, the city that has the highest percentage of Ritalin use in the United States is Salt Lake City. Number one in the world. And it's highest among upper-middle-class families. The wealthy white families are the ones most likely to put their children on Ritalin and other medications. Poor families are the least likely in the United States. It's not welfare recipients who are taking these pharmaceuticals. It is the middle class, the upper-middle-class, and the wealthy in the United States. I beg your pardon?
Where did you? If you speak in a lot of broad.
The Department of Health and Human Services. You can find it in my book, The Edison Gene.
Where is that located?
On Amazon.com. I mean, you can find it in any bookstore.
Right.
This is not some secret that I'm sharing with you. This is common knowledge in the psychiatric industry. The problem of psychiatric drugs in the United States is the result of a for-profit corporation pushing this stuff, for-profit industry pushing this stuff, not the result of welfare. Well, it's got nothing to do with
Democrats
welfare.
The Democrats doesn't stop it. All you do is criticize in negative generality, sir. It isn't true that all Republicans are bad or all Democrats are bad. You also have Hillary Clinton, who's a multimillionaire. You have Nancy Pelosi. You have all of the Democratic people.
I got it. Karen, I'm sorry. We're out of time. Your point was, I know. Yeah. Your point was well made. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, by the way, tomorrow I'll be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, live for a special broadcast, noon to 3 Eastern time, at the Celebration Cinema North. So if you are in Western Michigan, I'm going back to the town where I was born. I was born in Kent County Hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And also we'll be doing a book signing at Schuller's Bookstore on 28th Street in Grand Rapids at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. So drop by Celebration Cinema North tomorrow, noon to 3, or and I'll be doing book signing there shortly, right at the end of that. Or come to Schuller's Bookstore, even better, at 7 o'clock, 28th Street in Grand Rapids. It's all at WTKG.com. WTKG, our Clear Channel affiliate there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'll also be broadcasting Monday live from WDTW in Detroit, although there won't be a public event associated with it, but it'll be great to be there and see the folks there. So looking forward to that. Marilyn in Corrales, New Mexico, or Corrales?
Corrales.
Corrales. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Well, I was just thinking that everyone's sort of bouncing around. They're calling Bush, you know, emperor and a dictator, but no one is really thinking, how do you get there? And you get there by doing a self-coup or an auto-coup. And I just think that what's going on right now is a silent coup.
Yeah. I at the time in 2000, when the Supreme Court appointed Bush, when I mean, if, go back and read the Supreme Court case, Bush versus Gore, where Bush, the Supreme Court of Florida, ruled that every vote in Florida must be counted. Might take a few days, might take even a week, but every vote had to be counted. And so John Roberts helped put together a strategy to challenge that before Rehnquist, who Roberts used to work for as a clerk. John Roberts helped, you know, train the people to go to Washington, D.C. and say, no, if every vote is counted in Florida, George W. Bush will be irreparably harmed. And that was the ruling in Bush v. Gore, that case in which they said, no, every vote shall not be counted in Florida. We are going to stop the counting of the votes in Florida. And we know that a year later, when the consortium of newspapers actually counted all the votes, no matter how you count it, if you count every single vote in the state, whether it was undervotes, overvotes, pregnant chads, dimpled chads, hanging chads, intent of vote or not intent of vote or whatever criteria, Gore won the state of Florida. And when it was actually counted a year later. But the Supreme Court said in Bush versus Gore that George W. Bush personally would suffer irreparable harm every vote was counted in the state of Florida. It's right there in the Supreme Court ruling. It is mind-boggling. And I've been saying for the better part of, 7 years now, 6 years, that in and of itself was a coup. Two of the people on the Supreme Court had family members, direct family members, working on the Bush campaign, and three of them were appointed by Bush's father or his father's partner, you know, Ronald Reagan. And that was the beginning of the coup in my mind. So anyhow, Marilyn, thank you for your call and for your comment. Jim in Cambo, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. How are you? Hey, I was a Marine in Vietnam and another U.S. government manufactured war. And to your point of the about education, you know, to stop Nixon, it only happened when the middle class got radicalized, and that happened in part by public teach-ins. You know, people were aware of things on the ground when it became more a mass educative process on the part of the offended middle class. And so what would you recommend in today's reality, which is so strange, that could recall that sense of outrage and that would also touch the people who are either apathetic or just trying to pay their rent to, you know, to bring things forward so that more people would realize what's at stake to them in their own self-interest?
Well, a lot of that came out of Students for Democratic Society, which was originally created with a Port Huron statement as an organization that was devoted to social justice, not to ending the war in Vietnam. And, you know, it kind of morphed over time. I was in SDS in East Lansing, you know, back in the late 60s. And I think that, you know, Democracy for America is playing a role in that. There's a lot of national organizations. I'd say the blogosphere is playing a huge role in this. I think that there is kind of a rolling, ongoing teach-in. The problem is reaching out beyond our small percentage of people who are participating in this.
Exactly.
and reaching the vast majority of Americans. And the filter that prevents that from happening always has been and still is the traditional mainstream media, and we've got to figure out a way to burst through it. And you know, getting a million people into the streets very often is it, although, oddly, the last couple of times that there have been huge demonstrations, they've been, you know, weirdly not so much covered.
Yeah,
so,
muted.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. So, Jim, I think your point is really well taken, and hopefully some groups will be considering picking up the idea of teach-ins. I know the drive out the Bush regime folks are doing a good job of that. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi, Tom. You were asking before what we should be doing to avoid the impending problems with the takeover of the government. And I think, we on the left are still approaching this gunfight, coming to it with knives. And I think the most important thing right now is to keep people constantly noticing that there's a groundswell, like they have the percentages that they advertised and that are in favor of impeachment. And there's a rally September 15th in Washington, impeachbush.org is the only site I've seen so far that promotes it. But, you guys, meaning Air America, you have to coordinate amongst yourselves, like, Rush and Hannity and this guy Mark Levin do. You know, every half hour this should be something mentioned coming up on September 15th. And, have everyone talk to his neighbor.
Yeah. Let me, in fact, it's a very good suggestion. I'm going to drop a note to a couple of folks as soon as we finish this. As soon as the news begins here. Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you, and good and interesting comment. Coming up next, after the break, Daniel Brook is here on what I think is one of the most important books that I've read in the last decade. This is brilliant. It's called The Trap, my independent thinker book of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. You're going to be amazed. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back. On Saturday morning, Louise and I took the Amtrak, the train, from Portland up to Seattle. A beautiful three and a half hour ride. So that Saturday night, I could MC, or moderate, or whatever you call it, this panel that was being put on by Talk 1090 in Seattle, our affiliate there. And then on Sunday, we took the train back, and I brought along a book to read. And once I started it, I couldn't stop. I mean, it was just, it was that good. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. It's called The Trap by Daniel Brook. Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America is the subtitle. And I was so amazed by this book that when I got back, I sent a note to Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash.com, one of the great progressive news sites that is supported almost entirely by the sale of books. And so for the better part of 3-4 years now, I've been doing a monthly book review for them. I just, it's my contribution to BuzzFlash and to encourage people to buy a particular book that I think is really cool. And I said, Mark, I got the book of the month. This is the book of the year. Daniel Brook has written this book, The Trap, and he's with us here. Dan, and you can find it over, just go over to BuzzFlash.com and you'll find my review there. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's just so gratifying to get reactions like this. People fly through the book, and that's what every author wants to hear.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can tell you, I've written some books that get that kind of response, and I've written some books that don't get that kind of response. it's such a good feeling when you know that, hey, this is really a great book, and you've done it. You've really done it here. And so what this book does, first of all, I thought you did a brilliant job of puncturing a couple of myths in America. For example, the myth of the difference between security and freedom. But
yeah.
And I want to get back to that in just a minute. But first, you start out by basically describing the plight of the generation, of your generation. You graduated from Yale in 2000, the generation of my kids. I'm a bit older than you are. That is facing an economy and an America that's very different than the America that I faced going into the world of business in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, I mean, people my age are coming of age in a giant social experiment called Reaganomics. People your age were sort of grandfathered in. I mean, you finished school, I guess, maybe in the early 80s, is that fair to say?
No, the early 70s.
Early 70s, right. So, and you bought a house probably in the late 70s.
Yep.
Whereas people my age, you know, we're coming through now, and we're living in the aftermath of the decimation of the middle class. We're coming of age in a time when a middle-class income no longer buys a middle-class life. So right now, for college graduates, over a third of jobs no longer even include employer-provided health insurance for college graduates. The actual cost of a college education in the last generation at a private school has tripled in real dollars. You look at the housing market. I mean, what's allowing people your age to get a nice home equity loan is pricing out people my age from buying houses all over America. So the idea is to look at the society we've been born into, Reaganomics, and compare it with the society that was where FDR really set the model.
It's not your generation versus my generation at all. In fact, although there are a lot of conservatives that would like us to think that this is like, you know, selfish boomers exploiting the next generation, ain't got nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that the rules of the game changed in 1981 with the Reagan Revolution, and the rules of the game changed in a way that ended up screwing an entire generation that was coming down the road.
That's right. I mean, and just telling people my age how massively the rules changed is, I mean, people's jaws drop when you tell them that Ronald Reagan lowered the top tax bracket in the country from 70% to 28%. Or this is something even, you know, when I was researching the book, I found out, which is that when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, he got rid of the 100-year tradition of having no in-state tuition in the UC system.
Oh,
so
yeah,
now
I had checked that.
Come out of UC and they're in debt, and that's a new phenomenon. And I argue.
Oh, it's mind-boggling. I got to tell you, when I was a kid, I mean, Louise and I both on different occasions hitchhiked out to California from Michigan, where we grew up, and half my, well, not half, but a lot of my friends from Michigan went to California because they could get a free education. It was the tail end of that. It was the late 60s and early 70s. And Louise worked her way through college as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. She paid for 100% of her college education that way. I worked my way through college working as a DJ in radio, as a news broadcaster, and working in a gas station and a pizza joint. I mean, these were, and I was making like $2.30 an hour. Mm-hmm. It was possible for the middle class to go to college back in those days.
Yeah,
it was possible.
I say in the book now, when you see the tip jar at your local scoop shop and it says tips for college, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, the idea that someone can work a minimum wage job and get some tips scooping ice cream or making lattes and pay for college is just, it's just sort of a sick joke at this point. But the bigger picture is, in the book, I'm trying to look at the bill of goods that Americans were sold about what America is. I mean, we now, this conservative vision of America is now so firmly entrenched that we think the American dream is getting rich quick. American dream was always that you could work hard and have a middle-class life. We think the, quote, American model of higher education is you have a high tuition and you go into debt. But the American model of higher education is Thomas Jefferson's model, which he created in Virginia over 200 years ago, where you create a fine public institution that's free, so anyone who's bright and hardworking can get an education rather than just the children of the wealthy. And we have to flip the way we think about what America is.
Yeah, and your book is just one of the most eloquent dissectings of Reaganomics that I've come across. I think it's just absolutely marvelous. The meme, one of the memes that's out there that somehow what Reagan did was he brought us freedom, and that the nanny state, the idea that government should do things for people, diminishes freedom.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest bill of goods we've been sold is that as long as the government butts out and keeps the taxes low, that's what freedom is. Freedom is the right to spend your money how you see fit. And that's not the American vision of freedom as laid down by the founders. The American vision of freedom is that the talented rise to the top rather than just the wealthy or the children of the wealthy. So that in this way, equality and freedom are mutually reinforcing. So again, going back to Thomas Jefferson, you take an institution like the University of Virginia, which is explicitly founded by him. So the talented, rather than just the well-born could get an education. I mean, that's what ensures the possibility that everyone can flourish. And now you look at the statistics and you see we're the most class rigid society. We have the least social mobility. And as you pointed out in your review in BuzzFlash, social mobility statistics are really the best way of measuring freedom, and we're coming up short.
Yeah, yeah, tragically. What are some of the other points in the book that you? I mean, we have 2 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, the big idea of the book is that inequality matters for everyone. We usually think of rising economic inequality as, oh, that means the CEO now makes 400 times what the average factory floor worker makes. And, I mean, yes, that's true, but most of us aren't CEOs and we're not factory workers. So you look at how inequality affects individual both professions themselves and also the gaps between professions. So a generation ago, a big city teacher started, their starting pay was $2,000 less than a big city corporate lawyer. Now that gap is $100,000.
Right, $2,000 a year less.
$2,000 a year, not a month. Yeah, it's a year.
Yeah, in other words, a generation ago, you know, back when I was a kid, getting a job as a public school teacher meant that you would have a good, solid middle class life.
Right.
Now it means hold your breath, Charlie. It's going to be a tough ride. Or getting a job as a cop. You know, you point out that most people who are working as policemen, firemen, or women, or public school teachers can't afford to live in the communities that they're serving.
That's right, and that's a direct function of the decimation of the middle class. And we shouldn't scratch our heads and wonder why the middle class disappeared. The middle class disappeared because the policies that built a large middle class were repealed. We let the minimum wage fall. We decimated people's rights to form unions. And we let the lid off the top. So if we really want to address inequality, which is what's sinking the middle class, we have to bring up the bottom. We also have to hold down the top. And that's a message the Democrats need to hear.
Yeah, your point that we need to go back to, I mean, you don't come out and explicitly call for it, but it's fairly clear in the book, and I think, you know, we should. Let's return to at least a 70% tax on the wealthiest among us. If you take the 1951 tax tables, the people who were paying the 91% tax were not paying that tax until after the 3.2 millionth dollar that they had made.
Yeah, we have to rethink the way we think
in today's
about
dollars.
Income taxes. I mean, when you get up into, when people are making hundreds of million dollars a year, They're not spending that money. So at that point, you know, we got to address it.
Yeah, we absolutely do. The book is The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America. The author, Daniel Brook. You can find it, of course, in any bookstore, any place fine books are sold. My review of it is over at BuzzFlash.com as well. Daniel, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
And for writing a great book. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Hey, want a way to voice your progressive opinion, but maybe you're too nervous to do it on the radio, or maybe you want to voice your thoughts about a topic that we haven't covered? Well, just pick up the phone and give us a call at 503-323-6620, our comment line. We want to hear from you. 30 seconds or less, you never know, your diatribe may just make it on the air. So make it count. 503-323-6620. Public service of the Tom Hartman Program and AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, which is where we're... Our host station here, the mothership for this program on Air America Radio, coast to coast in the United States. 22 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey is with us from the Center for American Progress. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and also creates the daily news prep site, miccheckradio.org, americanprogress.org, and thinkprogress.org, the main websites there for the center. Christy, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great, and great to have you with us.
You've
been keeping an eye on the news that is slipping through the cracks or flying under the radar, but we all really should know about. And I know that you're on top of, for example, this story about the Bushies trying to hide what FEMA has discovered about their trailers.
This is absolutely incredible, and this is going to be in tomorrow's Washington Post. The story just hit. But you know my political crush on Congressman Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice. This is one of this is one of his babies, and he's following this very, very carefully. So we've at least got somebody on the case. But it turns out, last spring we found out that a lot of people who were living in FEMA trailers after Katrina hit were getting very, very sick, nosebleeds and dizzy and memory problems and all that sort of thing. And there are 75,000 families who are still living in these FEMA trailers. And so at the time, a group did some testing and found out the formaldehyde, toxic fumes of formaldehyde in these trailers was off the charts.
So where's the formaldehyde coming from? Is this from insulation, from carpet, or from plywood?
It's from all of the above, actually. Many of the cheap products used in these trailers, like pressboard and laminates, have a lot of formaldehyde in them as a preservative. And so they built these trailers with these products, and no one ever thought to think, well, maybe we shouldn't poison the people that we're saving from Katrina. So at the time, this came out, and we just found out today that FEMA was alerted to this, and they got the top officials at FEMA got together and decided not to test the trailers because they thought that that would make them legally liable if it turned out to be true that these trailers were filled with formaldehyde.
This is incredible. Now, I remember some years back, I don't know how long ago, 2, 3, 5, something like that, that a report came out noting that formaldehyde is now considered a carcinogen. And I remember it quite clearly because in college biology class, I worked around a lot of formaldehyde. You know,
you never forget that smell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I thought, geez, I wonder how much of that stuff I inhaled and, you know, do I have some kind of a time bomb in me? I mean, here we have a compound that's not just toxic on its face, but also has long-term toxicities in the form of carcinogenesis and other conditions as well. It causes kidney damage. It causes liver damage. In filling these homes, these 75,000 people living in these homes, what's being done about it?
Absolutely nothing, because the head of the FEMA's Office of General Counsel advised that they did no testing because it would, quote, imply FEMA's ownership of this issue. Well, of course it would. FEMA's the one who put them together. Big heck of a job. So Henry Waxman is on the case, and he's going to hold hearings, and he said that FEMA is supposed to exist to serve the public, but you know what? It's protecting Director Paulson from embarrassment instead, and that's a really bad thing. And think of all the kids. I mean, yeah, it's very bad for adults, but it's very bad for the kids. And when Paulson was called on this, the director of FEMA, he said, you know what, open the window and air these trailers out. Fine.
It is good advice. I mean, you know, it is good advice, but it's not the solution to the problem. It's sort
no,
of like, you know, yeah. Oh, you've got a broken leg. Well, you know, don't walk on it. Well, that's a good start, but okay. Exactly. Speaking of kids, ditch the sick kids, protect the insurance companies. New Bush policy.
This is a big fight coming. Big, big fight. President Bush this week reiterated his pledge that he's going to veto legislation that would renew the state children's health insurance program, or as all the insiders call it, SCHIP. And there are 9 million kids right now in the U.S. who don't have health insurance. And SCHIP is for families who are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, but yet still don't make enough money to purchase private insurance for kids. And so it's this great bipartisan legislation that's going through the Senate right now that would actually cover, at first they were saying 3.3 million kids, now it's going to be 4.1 million kids, by adding $35 billion to SCHIP. And President Bush says, no way, who cares about the sick kids? He's worried about the effect on the big insurance companies. He actually said that.
Wow. Well,
so
I guess
the legislation.
I guess, you know, at least we can see, you know, he's candid about it.
At least he's open in hating the poor sick kids, right?
There you go. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Wanna shout out. Shout out loud. Why don't you all just come on out? And we can tear it all down. Yeah. Tear it
Yeah, you and me both. We all have a part in the game. We've all got to get out there and get active. Time for our Best of the Rest of the News segment, where we bring together some of the best bloggers and news sources out there on the Internet and kick around the events of the day. Nancy Scola is with us. She is the chief blogger for Air America over at airamerica.com. I talk a lot about the blog at the Tom Hartman page, and a lot of you participate in it. There's also a blog on the homepage of Air America, right there at airamerica.com, and Nancy Scola is the blogger there. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and we're very happy to have you. And Matt Stoller is with us. He's a political activist and blogger in Washington, D.C. He was an editor over at MyDD from November of 2005 until June of 2007. Now has his a new blog, OpenLeft.com. OpenLeft.com, some fascinating information over there. And Matt Stoller, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. Thank you. Nancy, let's start with you. What do you see as the biggest couple of stories coming down the road, or that are, you know, that are right here right now that we really, really should be paying attention to?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I'd start with is that we've heard a little bit about in the past week or so, but I think it's going to ramp up and be an even bigger story, is the question of food safety. We're seeing a lot of information come out from China, the sort of food imports that we're bringing into the U.S. being unsafe, China sort of retaliating to what the U.S. has been raising a little bit of a stink over the quality of food that we're bringing in, China, you know, sort of banning Tyson, some other products from the U.S., and we saw Bush actually yesterday form a new cabinet-level commission on food safety, which was sort of an interesting turn of events. But the thing in my mind that I think we need to do with this story is sort of connected to the idea of this is a natural sort of outgrowth of small government. What Rick Perlstein over at the Campaign for America's Future calls E. coli conservatism. And it's this idea that, you know, we've sort of ramped down the level of FDA inspection on food imports while at the same time ramping up the food that we let multinational corporations bring into the country. And we're seeing sort of the natural outgrowth of that. So I think we're going to, you know, as we sort of get closer to the Olympics, we're going to sort of start to see more attention paid to the question of food safety.
E. coli conservatism. What a great meme. What a great phrase. That is a marvelous frame.
Yeah.
Matt Stoller, what do you see over at OpenLeft.com? What are you seeing as the biggest stories of the day?
Coming down the week next week?
No, the one right now. We'll get to those in just a second.
Well, sort of a little noticed attack that's going on right now by Fox News against JetBlue, and it's not something that many people are paying attention to. But what's happening is that JetBlue is one of the first corporate sponsors of Yearly Coast, which is a progressive convention, and building links between the corporate sector and the progressive sector is really important in terms of building political power. Fox News knows this, and so they're trying to get their viewers to attack and email JetBlue to try to get them to sever that link.
Here's just for our listeners, this is just a quick clip. This is from the Bill O'Reilly show on Fox News. Where the, you know, O'Reilly introduces it by saying, "We sent our reporter so and so out to," and this is the reporter shows up in front of the apartment of the CEO of JetBlue.
"Hey, Mr. Varger, Jesse Waters with Fox News. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. You mind if we ask you a few questions?
Regarding?
On the Daily Coast website, it says attacks against coalition forces in Iraq are legitimate. Does JetBlue subscribe to that kind of thinking?"
"There's really, you know, politics in our business. Really, it's not something that we mix."
"What about the Pope as a primate? Do you agree with that kind of thinking?"
Same. I mean, it's from the standpoint of running our business, that's what we do from an airline perspective. So there's really not alignment along those lines."
He finally gets down to saying,
"I think that people can draw their own conclusion. We're running and do that freely and go to work is really what I'm trying to do."
Oh, I'm sorry. Here it is.
"Do you think your sponsorship is kind of a tacit endorsement of this kind of thinking?"
"I think just the ability to leave my apartment and do that freely and go to work is really what I'm trying to do."
That's what it came down to. By the way, the Pope is a primate. In the Catholic Church, the people who are the senior leaders are referred to as primates. But nonetheless.
Well, there's two significant pieces to this. One is that what Fox News is doing is they're teaching corporate America a lesson. They are saying you should not do anything with progressives. And one of the problems with that is that in order to achieve change in the country, you have to build industry coalitions. And not all companies.
We need sponsors. Daily Kos needs sponsors. I mean, it's just. Yeah.
That's true. But
and for that matter, Fox News needs sponsors. I mean, this is what's so bizarre about it. It seems to me like Bill O'Reilly's opening a can that he, you know, or a box, or, you know, he's kind of like Pandora's box. He's going down a road that I really don't think anybody who's doing political commentary should be doing.
Well, and that's the subtext here. It's that earlier, a couple of weeks ago, I mean, they're also just going after revenge because we forced the cancellation of the Fox News, of some presidential debates on Fox News. We got our Democratic candidates to withdraw, and we really damaged Fox News' credibility by pointing out that they're actually a Republican propaganda arm. And it was a real embarrassment for them, the fact that these presidential candidates pulled out of their debate. There's also criticism of Home Depot for advertising on Fox News because Home Depot is trying to market themselves as green-friendly, and Fox News has all sorts of reporting on how global warming is a myth, et cetera, et cetera. So they are trying to hold on to their revenue streams and credibility, and they're going after what little revenue streams we have and our credibility because of our
value. Being the blogosphere, the progressive blogosphere.
It's not about blogosphere, really. It's about liberals. Any place where there are liberals who are trying to build political power, organized for their values, the right wing comes after them. And the blogosphere is one place where that happens. But you know, they've come after Air America. I mean, you've seen it. They pressure advertisers not to, come on to any sites that are potentially controversial. They pressure everybody who's advocating for values that they don't agree with, and they do it in aggressive and nasty ways. And we're one of the few places that is as hardcore about it as they are. But we organize for our values. So this it's not that a lot of these are the kind of fights that aren't really being paid attention to, but it's where change in some ways in the political landscape is happening. And Hillary Clinton's weighed in, and Chris Dodd has weighed in, and Center for American Progress has weighed in. So it's gotten some heavy hitters to on board this.
Yeah, I think that we just all should condemn this kind of behavior by Fox News. I mean, it's just I frankly don't call for boycotts of advertisers of conservative programming for the same reason that I don't think that there should be boycotts of advertisers of progressive programming. They're separate universes. I mean, it's you take on the ideas. Well, I don't need to get on a soapbox about it. Matt, thanks. Thank you for that. Nancy Scola, the chief blogger over at AirAmerica.com, speaking of progressive media, AirAmerica.com, what do you see coming down the road? What are the stories that are right now just kind of little bubbles that are going to become great big whatever the metaphor should be?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's going to sort of blow up over the next week or so is this congressional investigation into the death of Pat Tillman. Now, Tillman was the former NFL player for the Arizona Cardinals, I believe, who became a soldier, went to Afghanistan, died, and his sort of death was sort of celebrated for a while as, you know, the death of a great American hero. The Defense Department used him as sort of what his family ended up calling a poster boy for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Tillman, obviously, you know, he sort of had volunteered to go over, gave up a lucrative NFL contract, and that was sort of, gave the DOD something really, you know, when it was a rough time in the war, gave them something to sort of celebrate. Now, Tillman was killed by friendly fire, which I think most people sort of know now, but in the time that he died, the Defense Department refused to acknowledge that and told his family a different story. And so there's been a congressional investigation going on for a while now, and it's really sort of ramped up because there was a request made by the House Oversight Committee that has jurisdiction over this sort of thing for all the White House correspondents having to do with Tillman's death. What the White House sent back, which is probably not going to be surprising to you, is two pieces of information, one of which was a packet of press clippings. This sort of got, you know, some folks on the Hill, including some Republicans like Tom Davis of Virginia, and sort of Henry Waxman of California was leading this sort of charge to say this can't continue any longer. This sort of claims of executive privilege in, you know, using in a way just to sort of to cover your tracks. So that's
the one. This is the Bush claiming executive privilege to not tell us about Pat Tillman. I agree. It's going to be really interesting to see where this thing goes.
And when you sort of connect that with the fact of, you know, Barrett Myers not showing up to testify under claims of executive privilege, the Cheney Energy Task Force.
Yeah, it's the perfect storm. We have about a half a minute. Matt Stoller at openleft.com. What do you see as the small stories right now that are going to blow up in our faces here soon?
Well, there's a fight between John Dingell and Nancy Pelosi over CAFE standards, which are, you know, fuel economy standards. And it's a
John Dingell representing Michigan.
Yeah, it's a proxy fight for the whole global warming fight. And so there's about 20 to 40 congressmen that are watching and to see who wins. And so we might see a vote next week. And it would be very, very surprising if a sitting committee chair was over, you know, was beaten back by the Speaker of the House. It'd be a big fight. And it's the whole environmental community is just watching this with bated breath.
Yeah, Dingell is the chairman. Yeah, is the committee chair. That I agree. That's going to be fascinating too. Matt Stoller, he's with openleft.com. Nancy Scola, the chief blogger for Air America, airamerica.com. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Great talking with you. Talk Radio News will be with us right after the break. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels.
And Higgins.
Coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
And all the folks who work with us on this show, and all of you who listen, and all of our sponsors, and congratulations, by the way, to T. Windleborn. T. Windleborn, who, there we go, congratulations, who blogged over at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. Daniel Brook is the title. Thank you for having on Daniel Brook. I will definitely read this book. It's so important to me. My husband at 26 with serious college and trade school loans to pay back for the big credit cards. Both of us trying very hard to be very seriously involved in politics now. To hear someone who seems to know where we're coming from personally on a whole, I'm excited to read this book. I really respect Hartman's opinion, especially after reading two of his books. Viva Higgins. And David says, as a guy who's struggling with his own college loans, he felt some resonance with that one too. So, thank you for posting your blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Wendy Wang with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us in Washington, D.C. Hey, Wendy.
Hey there, Tom. How are you this afternoon?
I am just great, but I will get better. We're going to hop on a plane, head to Michigan tonight, and I'm going to visit family all over the weekend, and I'll be in Grand Rapids on Friday doing our show from WTKG and the Celebration Cinemas, and on Monday WDTW in Detroit, and we'll be back here in Portland on Tuesday. So, it's going to be a wild time. Anyhow, what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the president's feeling pretty good about himself after the Senate bill to draw the troops out of Iraq sort of died on the Senate floor, even after the Democrats tried to do an all-night debate session. And today you could see just how good and how confident this president felt, because he really went on an PR effort to kind of bring everyone into the fold. He sent out the ambassador of Iraq to do a satellite hearing with the Senate Armed Services Committee, and also the Lieutenant General, the commander of the multinational corps, gave via satellite as well a ground assessment of the situation in Iraq at the Pentagon, and that's what I was covering this morning. And all seems to be well, according to those gentlemen, and the situation in Iraq just needs some time. They need until September. No, wait, it's November. No, wait, it's actually September before they can actually show you just how well the surge is actually working.
Well, now that we have over 2 million people who have fled Iraq and another 2 million internally displaced refugees, and the neighborhoods in Baghdad that were 50-50 Shia-Sunni, or even 80% Sunni, 20% Shia, are now 100% Shia. Now that the ethnic cleansing has been largely successful and is becoming more and more aggressive, you know, more and more people being murdered, more and more people fleeing their homes, there's even the major growing entrepreneurial business in Iraq right now is brokers who, for a small fee, will arrange for Sunni families and Shia families to swap houses so that the Shia communities can become entirely Shia and the Sunni communities can become entirely Sunni. As that ethnic cleansing continues, violence is going to decrease.
It actually will be, because once you put the separation between the two sides in place and there's some kind of a divide there, it will perhaps put down the violence, but maybe it's only temporary, because there's also the long-term solution of what are we going to do with Iraq as a nation, because in our mind, the Western mind, we want them to have some sort of sectarian cohesiveness. And I think, you know, the West, of course, completely has a misunderstanding of just how strong the sectarian bonds are. And that also brings us to the issue of what will be the measure of success there, because the president keep saying that we're going to be successful. Will it be the decrease in violence, or are we going to see them to having a united nation?
Yeah. It ain't happening. What's happening is Iraq is being divided into three sectarian states, and it's being divided not by rational means, but by murder and mayhem and bloodshed and destruction and death. And that's the way that the Bush administration seems to do everything, it seems, if I may venture an editorial point. I'd like to submit to you, Wendy Wang, that the coverage of this vote yesterday in the Senate, or this failure to be able to take a vote, has been extraordinarily disingenuous. The fact of the matter is that this bill did not die on the floor of the Senate. The bill was never voted on. The bill would have passed. There were more than enough votes to pass the bill. The bill was successfully obstructed. And that should be the way that it's being covered. But I'm finding much of the news, many of the news reports, are saying that the bill failed, when in fact the bill did not fail. The ability of the senators to vote on the bill was obstructed.
And perhaps they will bring it up again after the August recess and come September, when the Petraeus report and the Pace report all come before these Congress, and we might see a revisit to the fact that, you know, we need to have some kind of solution for our troops in Iraq, and perhaps, you know, pull down, withdraw our troops may be the solution. But, you know, maybe in this form, not necessarily.
Yeah, we'll see. What else? Anything else going on in Washington, D.C. over the weekend here?
Well, we're just going to be talking a lot about Iraq, and, of course, the Congress is visiting other bills as well, including the Farm Bill and No Child Left Behind. We're going to be looking at other domestic issues. But, you know, this is going to be something that will come up yet again in September. And as the commander of the multinational corp said to us earlier today, he said that, you know, perhaps September is not the time line that we should be looking at, because that's just too short of a period to really see any kind of difference the surge might make, and perhaps we should move as far back as November before we can see any kind of a real effort being made in Iraq.
Amazing. And I'm guessing that none of the media is covering the explosion of the steam tunnel in New York as a failure of infrastructure.
The 89-year-old pipe tunnels are
Since 1924. Yeah. As a failure of conservative philosophy to support.
There
anyhow,
you go.
Wendy Wang, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks so much, Wendy, for being with us. By the way, thanks, you too. A quick heads up to all our listeners. Our interview from the first hour, Paul Craig Roberts, is up, the podcast, at 620kpoj.com. If you want to hear that interview in its entirety, it's right next to yesterday's interview with Bruce Fine. You click on the big graphic at the top of the page at 620kpoj.com. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, anything goes. Give us a call. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.